Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this hour of Forum, the life and legacy of Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
I think the genius of our Constitution is that over now more than two centuries, this notion of who counts has become ever more inclusive.
We'll talk about Justice Ginsburg's pioneering fight for gender equity as a young lawyer, as well as her most notable opinions as a U.S. Supreme Court justice. Plus, what her death means for issues like the Affordable Care Act, abortion, and the future of the court. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and what did she mean to you? That's all next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Crowds across the country mourned over the weekend for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died on Friday at the age of 87, following a years-long battle with pancreatic cancer. Prior to her appointment by President Clinton to the High Court, Justice Ginsburg devoted her legal career to the fight against sex discrimination, winning key victories that enshrined the 14th Amendment's promise of gender equality under the law. On the bench, she became a celebrity among progressives for her stinging dissents in cases involving civil rights, contraception, and perhaps most notably in Bush versus Gore, which halted a ballot recount in Florida and handed the presidency to George W. Bush. In this hour, we're going to talk about Justice Ginsburg's life and legacy, and let me first of all extend condolences to her loved ones and to her family and to all of those of you who are mourning her, because she was clearly such a giant, a woman under 5 feet who was, and in terms of American jurisprudence, a giant in every single way and an inspiration and heroic to so many of you. So I know there are many who are feeling her loss, and it cannot be overstated in terms of her historic stature. Joining us first is Wendy Williams. She's professor emeritus at Georgetown Law. She co-authored My Own Words with Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Mary Hartnett, and she's currently working on an authorized biography of Justice Ginsburg. She first met Justice Ginsburg in 1971, and welcome, Professor Williams. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you, and let's begin by talking, since you are writing a biography, about her life. I know you met her in 1971, but I think it's important, especially for younger listeners, to realize what she was up against. She's a cultural icon now, but the culture of the 50s, she really had three strikes against her. She was a woman, she was a Jew, and she was married.
Exactly. And then she added in a child, and that made it even harder.
And so when you met her, she was, this was actually when she was a tenured professor. She had just received her tenure as a professor, moving toward women's issues, moving toward really becoming the architect of women's issues and against discrimination against women.
Yes, when she got a teaching job at Rutgers in 1962, she was one of only two women hired in the United States on law faculties, and that had been a pattern for quite a long time. So you're right, the barriers are great. She had wanted to practice law, but none of the big law firms in New York City would hire her. So she clerked for a judge for a while in the Southern District of New York. One of her teachers from Harvard tried to get her a clerkship on the Supreme Court, but the justices weren't ready for a woman yet. So you're right. I mean, her history really captures the problems of that time. When she first went to work at Rutgers in 1962, she was this little bitty, early 30s, maybe she was even 28 or 29, actually, now that I think about it. She had gotten very interested in international law, and not just international law in general, but international law of the way courts proceed in civil cases, civil procedure, we call it, and her focus was on those comparisons for a project for at Columbia Law School for 2 years. And it was during that project where she spent time in Sweden. She learned Swedish. She did a book on civil procedure in Sweden. It was during that time, toward the end, that she was told by one of her mentors that there was an opening at Rutgers Law School. And knowing that women had a very hard time getting into law teaching, she decided she better take it and not wait around. And that's what she did. So she spent all those first years teaching first year civil procedure to students who were no doubt yawning continuously. I say that because as a former civil procedure teacher myself and a student of civil procedure at law school, it is the most hard to get excited about course taught in the law school, probably. I would put tax in that category too, but some people love tax. But anyway, so Ruth was teaching procedure, standing up in front of students, writing articles on procedure and international procedure, and minding her own business. And along came, around 1969, a new rising movement, and I'll call it the women's legal movement, because already Women's Lib was out there and getting a lot of publicity, but the Women Lawyers project was more focused on legislation and legal cases and developing the law in that area. So she publishes her last civil procedure articles in 1969. In the fall of 1969, she gets tenure by one vote, as did the one other woman on the faculty the year before. And she is inspired by her students to take some steps to put her talents to work on the question of what was then called sex discrimination.
So, and we should add that, I'm sorry, but let me move forward with that, because you met with her again, I believe, at Yale Law School, just right after, soon after that, and thus began,
yes,
kind of a revolution began with respect to women's rights.
Right, it after. Was a revolution. There's no other word for it. There had been very few articles, very few teachers of law who were interested in the subject. Textbooks usually made fun of women in their cases. And so this sort of powerful rising of students initially, women students were coming in because in the Vietnam War, law schools couldn't get enough guys to finance themselves. So they let the women in for the first time. And it changed. It was a sea change. So in 1969 at NYU Law School, there was the first course taught on women in law. It was sanctioned by the law school, but taught by an outsider and the students themselves. And that group of students put their heads together and began spreading the word. By 1970, there was founded a Women in the Law Conference, a National Women in the Law Conference. The first National Women in the Law Conference was in 1970 at NYU, and it wasn't very big, but it grew to include thousands and lasted all the way till 1990 and became the occasion for education. Ruth Ginsburg was at almost every one of those conferences in the early days. She was there, she was serious, she was tiny, she looked proper, and none of the rest of us did. We were young and radical people in those days. And she would speak about the Constitution. She also was supporting the Equal Rights Amendment and discussing that. And that would be her contribution. So I saw her every year at those conferences for a long time.
When did the ACLU founded that women's rights group that actually began to litigate? That really tied in with the revolution, what we're calling the revolution. I know there was in 1971 a landmark case called Reed versus Reed, which you might want to address too. But that whole ACLU project was really central, wasn't it?
Well, so this was the coming together of many things. At the ACLU, there was an uprising. They have biennial conferences, or did then. I'm not sure what they do now exactly. And the biennial conferences brought representatives of the ACLU from around the country for a conference in June, basically. And that conference, for the first time, had a rising up of the women there, and they had two big points, both of which got adopted by that body. And one was that the ACLU itself should get itself integrated on the basis of sex as well as race, and that the ACLU should prioritize cases involving gender equality. So that was very big. There's a door opening there. You can see, feel it. In the 1971 conference at Yale New Haven, it was a collection of some of those New Yorkers who were already working on things, and Ruth Ginsburg was there. And I remember, this is where I met her, of course, flying across the country on a plane. I was born in California and grew up in the mountains, and so this was my first big trip to the other coast. And there we were up in New Haven, Connecticut, a conference that included women interested in teaching women in the law courses and in helping promote or contribute to casebooks on the subject so that our students could be taught about it through casebooks, which is the way we teach law generally. And so a casebook was born at that conference. Ruth Ginsburg was there, and she, within a few months, had teamed up with two other people, one of them Herb McKay from UC Berkeley. And they, too, set to work on a casebook. And meanwhile, those of us who were there went home with a lot of it, pieces of paper describing where we could find articles and what the statistics were and how we might teach a course on women in the law. And so at that point, women went back all across the country and started Women in the Law.
Wendy Williams, we're coming up on a break here, and I want to extend thanks to you for joining us for these remembrances that you have provided us about Justice Ginsburg, who, as I said, certainly is being mourned, and the loss is being felt all over this country. Wendy Williams, good to have you with us, and I thank you.
Thanks.
That's Wendy Williams, Professor Emeritus, Georgetown Law, co-authored My Own Words with Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Mary Hartnett, and currently is working on an authorized biography of Justice Ginsburg. When we return, David Levine and Margaret Russell, a couple of local law professors, join us to talk more about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her legacy and her life. Stay tuned. That's up ahead. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Do you have questions about the life and legacy of Ruth Bader Ginsburg? And really, we're asking the question, what did she mean to you? We're talking about her life and legacy. And joining us now is David Levine, professor at UC Hastings College of the Law. Welcome, Professor Levine.
Good morning, Michael. For the record, I want you to know I'm drinking coffee with my notorious RBG coffee mug.
All right. Glad to have that.
I have one, too.
Margaret Russell, you have one as well. Margaret Russell, again, professor of law at Santa Clara University, joins us as well, both with their RBG coffee cups. Boy, she becomes such a cultural icon. There are RBG socks, there are RBG t-shirts. She was really beloved, and a woman of great rectitude, and a woman really of meticulous and disciplined shaping of the law and writing of the law. She was influenced at Cornell by Vladimir Nabokov, no less, told that she could write and write in pictures. And Margaret, let me begin with you. Let's talk about let's hear a cut first, because this kind of sums up a lot about Ruth Bader Ginsburg when she was asked a question about how many women should be justices on the court. You have that cut, Danny?
People ask me sometimes, when do you think it will be enough? When will there be enough women on the court? And my answer is, when there are nine.
Yeah, well, let me go back to you on this, Professor Russell, because the reality is that, and you teach courses in gender and the law, and I know that studying Justice Ginsburg and studying all of her decisions, particularly in some ways maybe her dissents as well, has given so many young women inspiration. What's at the heart of that?
Oh, absolutely. And before I begin, I have to say that both David Levine and I have something else in common with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and that we love civil procedure. So that's actually how.
And I do too.
Oh, terrific, Professor Williams. That's great. So I'm glad you asked that in terms of what she means to women, because I see her influence generationally by comparing women lawyers of my generation with hers, and then now teaching the youngest generation of lawyers in gender and law and constitutional law. I graduated from law school 25 years after Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And this is how I tell my students the significance between her time and mine. When she graduated, she had trouble getting a job, even though she was at the top of her class. She was a top performing student. She and other women were regularly asked questions like, and openly, why are you taking a spot that really should be for a man? You're going to get married. You're going to have children. You're taking up space. She was trying to start a family and work very hard, something that my women students really worry a lot about. How do you juggle that? And she did it so prodigiously, I think, that it's a little awe-inspiring. But what I mentioned to my students is that in this, you know, sort of passing along of the generations, she shines as someone who cares about justice. That's a sign in her chambers, justice, justice shall you pursue. And she was very aware of the hardships in her life and also the privileges in her life. She was very unpretentious in describing them. And I think she was very resolute in moving forward through life right to the end with grace and determination. So I think she is not just a seat on the court, obviously. She represents so much more.
And let's talk about what she represents, particularly in terms of cases with you, David Levine. I mean, we have to go back to 1996, first of all, and thinking about most significant cases, because that was a real turning point with the Virginia Military Institute.
Sure, absolutely, Michael, because it was, in a way, the culmination of that strategy that Professor Williams was starting to tell us about, where Justice Ginsburg, as a litigator, so brilliantly found the cases to bring the issues to the fore so that the Supreme Court justices, lower court judges, essentially all men, could understand it. And so one of the brilliant things that she did is that she found cases, those early ones, where men were at a disadvantage. And she was able to show the discrimination, the stupidity of the discrimination that way. And then with VMI, where she was able to write a 7-to-1 majority opinion, she really enshrined that, because at VMI, an all-male institution with very rigorous physical standards and all to go into it, Virginia, when they were challenged, actually set up a weaker program for women. Talk about separate but equal. And Justice Ginsburg was having none of it. Even if very few women would be able to meet the particular standards of VMI or might be interested in that kind of a life, it needed to be open. And so that what I would say what she did is she helped us to knock down stereotypes in all sorts of areas, whether it was disability, whether it was women's rights. And also, I think she was very proud of essentially creating men's liberation as well, in the sense of equality. One of her clients was somebody who was trying to take care of his kids and wasn't getting a benefit. And she was able to use that as a case to show the unfairness. So I think it's not just that she's a role model for women, but for men who want to have a life that encompasses all sorts of parts, and that there's no discrimination or stereotypes against anybody.
David Levine is professor at UC Hastings College of the Law. Wendy Williams, again, is professor emeritus at Georgetown Law. I'm going to go back to you, Professor Williams, since we're evaluating Justice Ginsburg's career and looking at it from a broad perspective. One has to say she was not only, this is a word that's been unfortunately put in a, well, George Orwell wrote about this word being overused so much that it lost its meaning, but she was a leader of a, what we could describe as liberalism, whether it was gender discrimination or whether it was abortion and reproductive rights, affirmative action, workers' rights. I mean, across the board, what used to be the best of, in many people's minds, what liberalism was, and she was a liberal leader on the court.
She was remarkable in her ability to, in the early days on the court, try to follow in the lead of and build on what the Warren Court had done before her, and was now a lost opportunity. So when she was going to the Supreme Court with that first case, Reed versus Reed, she was facing a court that had a new Chief Justice, Warren Burger, and she was facing a court that in its whole history had never written a case recognizing the full personhood and equality of women. So, so it was kind of a steep ladder she was climbing, but she wrote a brief in that case, which was remarkable. She gave the history of the differences in treatment under law of men and women, and she wove that into arguments for how the court should look at the case, and she won. She won for all of us. Now, it wasn't the case that she wanted, in the sense that they did not proclaim any big new principle of women's equality. But there was a hint there of something new. And what was absolutely new was that they held in favor of women's equality. So that was case number one. And from there, she wanted to go on and develop the cases. And as David has told you, there were several really important cases of hers after that that took the law even further.
Well, and David, if I go back to you on this, I mean, she even recently was right at the center of an LGBT case. I mean, as I say, when you think about what at least was the hallmark of liberalism or what epitomized the ideals of liberalism, whether it's gun control or religious cases, reproductive rights, she was the leader and really at the center of those cases. And even the cases that she wrote dissents in were quite famous, and she felt that they would last, and she hoped that they would be part of her posterity.
Oh, absolutely. One that comes to mind is the Lilly Ledbetter case, Ledbetter versus Goodyear, where Lilly Ledbetter had been denied equal pay, and her employer had hid that from her. And the question in the case was not only could she sue, but how far back could she sue, because she had lost a lot of money because of what had been hidden from her. And the majority said, well, it was a short period of time. She couldn't go back very far. And Justice Ginsburg wrote a terrific dissent there. And she ended up saying the Congress should fix this. And I think the way she ended it was on the order of the ball is in your court. And in fact, the first piece of legislation that President Obama signed was in fact the Lilly Ledbetter Act, which fixed that problem. And so that you can just see cause and effect from her dissent absolutely changed minds in Congress.
Yeah, let's hear Justice Ginsburg on the value of writing dissents.
You're writing for a future age, and your hope is that with time, the court will see it the way you do.
And Margaret Russell, Margaret Russell Gaines, professor of law at Santa Clara University, I'd like your thoughts about something that I know you've given some thought to, and that is the relationship that she had. She may have been a liberal's liberal for much of her career, but she had this loving friendship with Scalia, who was as much an ideologue on the conservative side as she may have been on the liberal side, which I think should be in some ways inspiring that people can go across the lines and still have, they both loved opera, they both were very dear to each other, and I love one of her statements where she said, I love him, but sometimes I feel I'd like to strangle him. And yet they traveled together. They went to India together. They were on a famous photo of them on an elephant together. It was really in some ways inspiring, wasn't it?
think so. And I know some would scratch their heads and say, something's wrong with her to be friends with him. But I did observe it and read interviews with them over the years. She was very open about saying he made her laugh. And they did have this shared love of opera, and with their spouses, used to get together, I think, every holiday season in the tradition. So, and I think that that often love and chemistry and common interest really does transcend political difference. And that is a very good example.
Well, a very good example also that we ought to highlight is her husband, Marty Ginsburg, who was a famous and distinguished tax lawyer in his own right, but he was her biggest supporter. He was also pretty good in the kitchen, from what I've read. And let me go back to you on that, Wendy Williams. She didn't even know how to operate an oven. There's in Nina Totenberg's remembrances of her, she said something about Ruth should warm something up, but she didn't know how to operate an oven or use an oven because Marty did everything in the kitchen, and he was really, in the best sense of the word, a feminist.
He was, in the best sense of the word, a feminist. And she was a terrible cook. I mean, she did the cooking early on, and it was, by all accounts, by that I mean her daughter, her son, her spouse, terrible. And so he took over in the kitchen, and things really were upgraded. That happened clear back in the Rutgers years, and was carried forth ever after, and probably gave her a little extra time too to do all the work she was doing, which was extraordinary. I mean, she was working, she was teaching law full time, she was doing ACLU Supreme Court cases on gender, she was writing articles, she was giving talks, she was working with the American Association of Law Schools to convince it to support women's equality, which it did in an important way very early on. And so he was a blessing. He really loved her. And he told jokes. She needed to laugh. I like what was just said about laughing, because when she was working so hard, her children had this little book in which they recorded whenever she laughed, because she was so serious and tired all the time. So, but
can I just insert a couple of examples of her humor that I mentioned? Nina Totenberg's remembrances of her, and I think these are illustrative in some ways. We were talking about her husband, Marty. He was getting radiation, and the doctor said it was very unlikely that they would be able to have another child because of the radiation, but she got pregnant. And when she went to see the doctor, according to Nina Totenberg's account, she said to the doctor, you have to tell me who the father is in this, right, if I can ask. She had that kind of humor. It's also in Nina Totenberg's remembrances, there's a when Nina Totenberg's second husband, her first husband died, who was a surgeon, she started dating him, and she asked, she told Justice Ginsburg, who she was friends with for decades, about the fact that she was dating someone, and she said Justice Ginsburg's response was, details, I want details, you know, which is really, again, one of those illustrative stories.
She got funnier as things went along. She was shy and serious and focused. There's one story that I haven't heard told anywhere, but I read about it in the student newspaper, which was that at Rutgers, it must have been 1969 or 70, the students had an annual show in which they mocked their professor. And the one that mocked her showed a student playing her behind the desk, standing there lecturing, and somebody behind her, I don't know whether it was male or female, undressing her, and she didn't notice. So the thing she was up against, I mean, everybody was laughing, she was in the audience, and there she was being undressed as a way of showing how serious she is. She lightened up, and I think the point that Scalia made her laugh is really important, really important. That was a big thing. But the other thing, of course, was opera, which is the only place I think she actually got tears in her eyes over anything.
Let me just add, since we're talking about her humor, one of the things that certainly impressed me about her was her toughness. I mean, this is a woman who went through a number of cases of cancer personally, fought through them, worked through them, and stayed at the job, so to speak. She had 5 bouts of cancer. She had broken ribs. She had blocked arteries that required a stent. In other words, tremendous pain, and yet she was able to work out all the time. I go back, David Levine, to a quick story from you on this. It's a funny story, too, in many ways. You were with her in Tuscany?
Correct.
You want to talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, I had the privilege of co-teaching with her for a summer course in Siena, and which was, you know, terrific. And we did a moot court where my wife and I were her associate justices, and she was the chief, and the students got to argue. But the story is that the head of the program asked my wife and myself to take the Ginsbergs out to dinner. And what was arranged is that we would go to some really pretty restaurant, which was out near an old castle under the stars, under the vineyards. And it was my job to drive everybody. And if anybody's been in Tuscany or driven in Italy, you know that the roads are narrow. The drivers are bold.
Excuse me, David, they call it a blood sport, driving in Tuscany.
You bet. And so there I am. And it's like, okay, it's my honor to do this. And I'm trying to find my way. And I notice that she's not wearing her seatbelt. And Marty told her, Ruth, put on your seatbelt. And she just, I don't like seatbelts. So she just wouldn't do it. So I felt like the fate of the nation was in my hands at that point, as we had to navigate over to the restaurant. And then worse, coming back in the dark after, let's say, we tried a little wine during dinner. But I did get her back safely. But I'm glad, it was a pleasure to be with her for that week.
You saved it for us, and now you have the coffee cup in front of you as a remembrance. I want to read some comments that are coming in as we come up on a break. Sherry writes, while everyone calls her a feminist, she was more of a humanist. She strived to equalize people under the law, even if she didn't want to wear a seatbelt. Here's Marjorie, who writes, I met RBG in 1978 when I had the chance to invite her to speak at the University of Puget Sound when she was at Columbia. I was in awe of her even then. She had already made such a huge contribution to expanding equality. She was so gracious, regal, and brilliant. She's been one of my heroines for at least 40 years. And Pete tweets, did RBG subscribe to an ideology? I don't think so. Please don't label her as someone who was devoted to equality, necessarily a liberal. Well, we can come back and talk about that a little bit. We'll talk more. Please feel free to join us toll-free 866-733-6786 or on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the life and legacy of Ruth Bader Ginsburg with 3 distinguished professors of law, Wendy Williams, David Levine, and Margaret Russell. And we certainly welcome you. And you can become involved in this program. If you have some memories or some questions about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, please feel free to let us know what she means to you. In fact, you can do that by giving us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. We haven't even gotten into the politics yet, but I want to get in, Margaret Russell, with you to this notion of liberal. She was known as the leader of the liberal flank of the court. That label certainly is a label that is associated with all kinds of things. It has multivalent meanings, but and ideological meanings, but it's not necessarily inappropriate, is it?
I would call her liberal, certainly. And depending upon how you define liberal and what you presume underlies it, or conservative, it could be a good or bad thing. But this is what I think it means in her context. Justice Ginsburg was very clear, precise in her writing, her analysis. She spoke her mind. She asked questions in oral argument very quietly, but, you know, very firmly. And when she was asked questions about being a judge, she said, I am relying on the record of that case, the facts and the law. And I don't think a judge should play to the home crowd, was the phrase that she used. So the liberal conservative approach, as well as the original text versus, you know, not just the original text approach, it also encompasses different people's sense of what justice and equality mean. And I think what Ruth Bader Ginsburg brought to the court, and certainly Thurgood Marshall brought to the court was a construction of justice that was very capacious and that recognized particularly harms against women, but she made decisions in a whole range of areas and it was very justice focused. It wasn't favoring one team versus the other.
Well, you mentioned Justice Marshall. She's been compared in terms of being an architect of women's rights to Justice Marshall and the work he did on behalf of civil rights and behalf of particularly African-Americans. And Margaret, as an African-American woman, I'd like your response to a tweet here from a listener who says, I learned something surprising about RBG while trying to figure out the possible black women that Joe Biden would choose as a running mate. In 23 years, Justice Ginsburg had only a single African-American clerk out of a possible 108. She did have equal numbers of men and women. We fact-checked that, and what's your response, Margaret?
Well, that's really a shame. I mean, I have no insight into her clerk hiring, but I know other justices have done much better, and I don't know what her answer would be to that. But certainly, I think that, well, let me put it this way, since you asked as an African-American woman, what sticks with me, I think, about the way she lived her life and her jurisprudence and her career gives me great hope that I and the next generation of lawyers and law professors will rely upon her approach in pushing the door open to push it open in many ways. Some people would say kick the door down.
You did have some concern, though, about what ultimately she tendered an apology for, and I'm talking about not President Trump, who she called egotistical and said was a fake, and she apologized. She apologized for that because it was inappropriate in so many people's minds for her to say those things as a justice. But you were critical of the fact that she was critical of Colin Kaepernick's kneeling and called it ridiculous and dumb, right? She did apologize for that as well, though.
Yes. So I actually think it's correct that sitting justices should not kind of let lots of things slip from their lips. And even the earlier Trump comment, I thought, well, you know, what she said may be true, but it shouldn't be coming from a sitting justice on the Supreme Court. I was very disappointed, actually angry, when I first read the quote about Colin Kaepernick. And my initial impression, because she was saying, oh, that's really dumb. Why would athletes do that, take a knee? I thought, she doesn't really understand what this is about. And I think within a couple of days, someone had schooled her, and she did apologize.
And here's a caller, Carrie, joining us from San Jose. Carrie, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to know if your guest could talk a little bit about her dissent in Citizens United, which she has said is the worst court decision in modern times.
David Levine.
Sure. Well, I do think it's one of the most significant cases in terms of how it has changed our politics. And she was absolutely right in terms of predicting some of the harm. I mean, look at the money that is flowing in at this point, hundreds of millions of dollars. So on that, I think she was absolutely dead right. The other one I would put in the same category would be Shelby County versus Holder, where the majority eviscerated the Voting Rights Act. And Justice Ginsburg famously said, this is like throwing away your umbrella during a rainstorm just because you're not getting wet, in the sense of it was preventing a lot of harm, a lot of things that we're seeing now. So those two opinions are tremendously affecting our election right now. And I think she was absolutely right in both cases to warn us as to how misguided both of those opinions were by the majority.
Well, we got one of her sort of deathbed wishes, and maybe you can comment on this, Wendy Williams. Her granddaughter said that she said that she hopes that another president will be able to name her replacement. It sounded like, in fact, she used the word fervent. It's a fervent wish of hers. It sounded certainly like a deathbed wish, and now we've got this situation where there seems to be an avoidance by Mitch McConnell of principles which he laid down in 2016 and not even having a hearing for Merrick Garland.
Oh, this is just so painful. She was trying very hard to stay alive, as most people recognize. She did her best. Hey, and I asked her last day, she think it was what she asked her granddaughter to reveal to people. And her granddaughter, who is also a lawyer, and her daughter, who's also a lawyer, were there with her when she died. So she was very grateful to them and her family for showing up and helping her through this.
And let me bring another caller aboard here. James joins us. James, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, Michael. Thank you for taking the call. And again, this is another great program. Listening to the program, the term liberal seems to be being thrown back and forth to define Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I think that's in many ways a misnomer for her. I think above and beyond anything else, she was an intellectual. She wasn't trying to be a crusader for liberalism, liberal causes. I don't think that really describes her. I think in the Congress, people embrace those terms. I want to be a conservative. I'm a liberal. I'm, you know, because that's who they are and that's what they think, you know, will advance them. I think what she did, now, I guess, understand and are much more familiar with her decisions and her opinions and her decisions than I did. I didn't really study her, but I really got the impression Ruth Bader Ginsburg, above and beyond, was an intellectual who made her ideas palatable to people like me who can understand what she was about, and that's the essence of who she is, an intellectual above and beyond being a liberal.
James, I appreciate that, and I would agree with you that she was an intellectual. We had talked about this a moment ago, but you say that she sided with what was known as the liberal wing in almost all major cases, and that was a bloc, and it was described as the liberal wing. So if you want to get rid of that notion, you may have to change the history books in terms of the use of liberal that was there. But I thank you for that contribution, and I thank you for the call. And I'm wondering, as we come up on a break here, there are 264 days before the election, Margaret Sullivan, when it was decided by Mitch McConnell and that administration that Senate under his rule not to move forward with the nomination of Merrick Garland. There are only 46 days now till a decision is made by the United States citizens who will be the next president. And yet there is this attempt to kind of ramrod through. In fact, McConnell said, keep your powder dry. We're going to get this on the Senate floor right away.
Is that, Michael, I'm sorry, is that question for me?
Yeah, I wanted to hear your thoughts on this, Margaret.
Yes. Well, it's so absurd. It speaks for itself. It's clearly dishonest and inconsistent with what they did so vociferously when Merrick Garland was nominated far earlier in the election year. And I can think of no plausible defense of that other than just dirty politics.
Well, David Levine, it may be dirty politics, but McConnell's saying, well, you know, it's a different configuration now. The Senate is in a majority of the present party, and that's different than it was with Merrick Garland. And the Democrats, really, what tools do they have here? They're talking about maybe halting things. Pelosi's talking about impeachment. They're talking about packing the court and putting more justices, even talking about getting rid of the filibuster.
Right. Well, in the short term, the Democrats' hope is that four Republicans or perhaps two more Republican senators will find a backbone and will say to Senator McConnell that this is not right, that we did follow a rule that they even were calling the Biden rule when they stopped Merrick Garland, and that we should stick with that rule. Apparently, Senator Murkowski and perhaps Susan Collins, I always worry about whether she's going to carry through, but at least the two of them have said that they don't think it should move so fast. So if there are four Republicans who break away, then Senator McConnell can't jam something through. So the politics are very dicey. And you know, the question of, do you try to jam something through in less than 7 weeks before the election? Do you have a nominee before then and then have the hearings or perhaps the vote afterwards, or what, is fraught for a lot of people. So it's really that question of, can you find four Republicans to stand up to Senator McConnell and President Trump to say, no, we're going to follow our previous principled stand as we had it with Judge Garland, and stick with that, and then see what happens after the election.
It is fraught, and it is certainly, I think, contingent maybe on some Senate races too, in purple states or states that are blue. But we will obviously monitor this as carefully as we can, and We've got some likely candidates if President Trump does try to push through with Mitch McConnell, someone to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg. He's already named Federalist candidates and likely candidates and said that he would probably pick a woman. This is, by the way, a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. And for more information about how to support this radio station, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny, and you're listening to Forum again on this public radio station, KQED FM in San Francisco. Let me go to a tweet here from Nora, who writes, I taught my husband to be a feminist. He cooked and changed a lot of diapers while I worked and nursed migraines. A lawyer friend of mine said, we all need a Marty. And another comment from Jean, whether it was overcoming religious, sexual, and political prejudices of the times or her later illnesses later in life, she kept on fighting the good fight. She was one tough lady. Her passing is another bright light extinguished, bringing further darkness to our land with hopes for a more perfect union. Been a tough 2020. Wendy Williams, you're writing a biography of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You said it's tough to be her biographer. Why is it tough to be her biographer, this tough lady?
Well, one reason it's tough is because she never slept. So for every one day I live, and I'm 11 years younger than she was, she has 2 days going for her in terms of work. So I always felt it wasn't quite fair. I wish it had been the other way around. But she was so remarkable. One of the things that nobody's mentioned yet, but whenever anybody did something nice to her or had a birthday or whatever, she remembered them all and she wrote little thank you notes. I have thank you notes from her going clear back to the 70s, and everybody who's dealt with her has had that experience over time of her. It wasn't that she was just a total intellectual and up in the air somewhere. She also, in a very human way, cared about each individual. And I think that's part of the driving force behind her understanding of the Constitution. I mean, remember that the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause, guarantees to every person equal protection under the laws. And she took person very seriously. And she looked at the facts of cases. She looked at the history behind the cases. She believed that she had to take human life, human dignity, very seriously.
Well, there's a story that comes to mind. Again, Nina Totenberg's remembrances. She talks about a club called the Cosmo Club in Washington, D.C., which opened up to women in the late 80s. And she was invited to apply, and she said she had some qualms about it, but she applied, and she was blackballed. That's the term they used at the time for somebody who was not given one person who would vote against someone and that would exclude them. And she said that a few years later, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was invited. She was given a tour, and they asked her if she wanted to be a member. And she said, a club that is too good for Nina Totenberg is too good for me, too. I think that's an instructive story about the kind of person she was. And we're learning a lot about this great pioneer in the course of this hour. Let's go back to politics, though, David Levine, in the little time we have left. How do you see this shaping up, particularly in terms of who the replacement is going to be and how the fight's going to proceed?
Well, apparently President Trump told his friends at Fox this morning that he planned to make his nomination on Friday or Saturday, that he was going to at least wait for Justice Ginsburg's services and funeral, and then go ahead. And the two names you hear the most are Amy Coney Barrett from the Seventh Circuit and Judge Barbara LaGoya from the 11th Circuit. So we could talk about them a little bit. They're both interesting possibilities. They would be about as polar opposite to Justice Ginsburg as could be imagined.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, particularly in terms of, you remember the confirmation hearings for Justice Barrett when Dianne Feinstein, Senator Feinstein, said to her, you know, you're an ideologue. It was on the question of abortion. And she said she felt quite uncomfortable with that. Back, though, to Justice Ginsburg's working habits, a listener writes, RBG worked all night. A clerk once left a message on her phone in the middle of the night, not expecting her to answer, but she did. I'd like to go back to you with a little time left here, Margaret Russell, and get your thoughts about her, particularly, again, in terms of the inspiration of your students, and especially on the questions of gender.
Yes, I had mentioned before that the generational change has been pretty dramatic, even though, of course, it's far overdue. There were 3% women lawyers when she first became a lawyer, 3%. And now there are about 50% of law school enrollment is women. So in the time, the 25 years between her and my graduation from law school, many of the questions that she was asked and many of the barriers that she faced became illegal. Sexual harassment became illegal. Discriminating in employment became illegal. Of course, it still happened. But the fact that there was that enormous change in the generation in which she and Professor Williams were part, the sort of the pioneering generation of a feminist interpretation of the law, I think has made a tremendous difference for all.
And I'll just add one other story that I came across when she was 18 years old. A employer sexually harassed her, and she stood up and said, "How dare you?" That, and said it twice. I mean, in those days, a lot of women put up with it, unfortunately, but she clearly didn't. And that says a great deal about who she would become and the kind of law that she would practice and interpret. Thank you all for joining us for this important hour on the legacy and life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Wendy Williams, David Levine, Margaret Russell. Indebted to you all for a good hour and an important hour. And for all of you who are listening to us, stay safe. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.